There we go. All right, so good. Welcome back to the Beit Midrash. We're going to continue our learning in Masechet Tanit. And I'd like to start by dedicating the shiur tonight to Refuah Shlema, the Moshe Chaim ben Leah, our friend Herb Shapiro. Herb, you should have a Refuah Shlema too, and feel good. Our friend Herb Lukashak, who is also right now, just finding strength and connecting with his beloved Judy, and had a great chavruta with him this morning, and talked about the soul and about what it means to be 96 and have a whole lot of experience under your belt, and just have a lot to treasure in life. So, imlo l'kol aguf, if not for all his body, but a healing of body we'll take too, but definitely a healing of the nefesh, neshama of soul. But he may yet get back to shul. That's what he says. I'll see you at shul, Rabbi. So good. We'll see you here, Herb. Hopefully. So refuah shlema. So I'm on 8B1. And I want to start on the right side and just show you a little piece tonight over here. And then I want to get into the issue. I mean, we've talked about rain and we've talked about the liturgy of rain, but the Masechet is called Tani, which means fasting, which means a fast. So tonight I want to get into the inyan of fasting. And I want to do some inside the Masechet of Gemara that we're learning in, and I want to do some outside as well, because I put together a source sheet for us that has lots of different places, Mekomot, texts that relate to the topic. So let's dive in here, though. And the place I want to start is over here when there was a time of a deathly plague and a famine happening together. So I'm on the right-hand column, if you're in the art scroll, of 8B1. B'yimei Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani hava kafna u'motzana. In the days of Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, there was both famine and a deathly plague. Amare, they asked, Heichi Navi, what shall we do? Ni by Rachame Atarte, shall we pray for the elimination of both calamities? Lo Afshar, that's not possible. So, right from that kind of assertion that it's lo efshar, it's not possible to pray for the elimination of two different aspects of what we're suffering from. It's an interesting assertion, right?
But yeah, what's the basis?
Yeah, so we look at it as if, first of all, it seems to be stated as if we understand this. You know, muvan me'elav. It's understood.
It's a given.
It's a given. We don't pray for two things to be taken care of at the hands of heaven. If it's a famine we're after, let's pray that the famine be, that we be rid of the famine. And if it's the plague we're after, let's pray that the plague be lifted.
No, but they can split the group to two people.
So already we have a chacham, right?
Say, God, as long as we have your attention, it's also a famine.
Right, and we didn't really pray for the famine, since we just relied on having God's attention vis-a-vis the plague, right? So let's say we go with Ron's thought. You can't pray for two things, it's a given, therefore split the group in two. Go with Arthur's. We're not really praying for two things. We're praying for the plague, but while we have your attention, could you take care of the famine too? Right? Oh, all these seem to be reasonable if I was to actually agree with the assertion that it seems to be making, that you don't pray for two things at once. And as a matter of fact, just to to double down on the notion that it's simply just making that assertion, and there's kind of like no and that there's no argument about that, right? It's a given, as Dale said it. It's a given. Atarte, Rashi says, we don't pray for two things.
Like, why not?
Oh, so, you know, like, that's really why I'm stopping here.
Being greedy?
I don't know. It didn't say for what reason so far. Let's see if it says a reason, but go back to think about what the reason might be that we could even make the assertion and it would seem like people would be in agreement. Right? So that's an interesting thought. It's because we're too greedy? You know, like, stick to one thing, because otherwise you're a snorer. You don't want to become a prayer snorer. What's another reason that we might not pray for two things? Okay, so how could I possibly have the truest kavanah that I need, the intentionality that needs to be there, if I'm doubling up, right? The problem with that argument, which I thought about as well, came to me when I thought about what we pray for vis-a-vis, like, let's say, right at the outset of a new month, or right before a new month, we have what's called Shabbat Mevarchim, right? So we take and we stand up with the Torah at Shabbat Mevarchim. We stand up and we sing this beautiful tefillah. Yihi ratzon milefanecha. And we are asking for just about everything that you could.
Our entire liturgy is filled with asking for lots of stuff at the same time.
Right. So you know, in terms of, again, I'm reading this assertion as if it was the given that I'm making it out to be. It seems to be that there's this one Daya, there's one opinion here that holds that really we shouldn't be doing that. For Kavanah purposes? So, let's though say, no, it really is for Kavanah purposes. What do I really mean when I say that in this context? What I really mean is that I have to relate to a philosophy of dealing with suffering. That is, I have to take each separate or each individual kind of plague, kind of ke'ev, pain, kind of problem. And I have to arrange my prayers so carefully about each of those individual plights and understand what I'm really asking for. That it's worth my while to have this kind of given, this limud, that no, I really can't but ask for God to help us with one possible area that plagues us.
Every day in the Amidah, three times, we ask for plenty and we ask for...
No, when I ask for them, you ask for many.
It's for healing.
Right.
So
I think, though... Again, like, even though my standard liturgy, I'm just trying to get into the mindset here, is bundling up a lot of different requests all at once, that here we have a little bit of a lesson about how to think through the kind of challenges and the kind of suffering that we face. And that if I was to apply that kind of lesson I'm to learn from here, that is, that I need to really concentrate on each one particularly, and that one, in a second we're going to see, like, will one lead to the elimination of the other, and that's going to be the question. But if I'm to really ask for that with full Kavanah intentionality, and what it's doing not only to me, but to my neighbors, and to the world potentially, and maybe I'm asking God to do his part, and I'm also asking for my ability to do my part, maybe if I have that true Kavanah about the one area, then when I get to a prayer like the one before Rosh Chodesh, Mevarchim Chodesh, when I get to the Amidah that bundles X, Y, Z, what I've learned philosophically is that I really have to have the right intentionality for each and every one of those that's in a liturgy that seems to be bundled.
Well, but this, it doesn't say here, can we, is it just inappropriate to put them in one prayer? Just says, shall we pray? And he's saying you don't pray for the alleviation of two afflictions at once. Are you suggesting that so long as there's an individual prayer for each, we're okay?
I'm suggesting that on a certain level here, what it sounds like is that there's got to be at least kavanah for each of these as individual items. And we don't want to bundle that all up into kind of one line of prayer. Now, maybe because we use a liturgy that enumerates and lists the kinds of things we either want to request or the things we want eliminated, we take care of the problem, maybe. I'm just trying to learn something from that kind of just hard stop philosophical assertion that I don't bundle my prayers and pray for two things at once. You know, just like ha'osefa mitzvah patormina mitzvah. Take another concept within halacha. If I'm doing one mitzvah, I'm really exempt from this other mitzvah. Right? I don't have to stop while I'm doing this mitzvah and read my Shema and do that mitzvah while I'm doing this mitzvah. While I'm praying for the plague to be lifted, can I really pray for the famine to stop? The assertion here philosophically, in terms of a prayer philosophy, is that in terms of the positive, whatever I'm, you know, constructive tefillah philosophy, or constructive tefillah kavanah, an approach to tefillah, is that I want to learn from that assertion something good about the way I pray. And here, I'm going to learn that I have to have kavanah for each of those elements disparately in the way that God expects me to be a good prayer when it comes to those requests.
Well, I agree 100% with the way you've articulated it, but it wasn't clear to me here that they're saying it just can't be bundled. It's okay to pray for two disparate things so long as you do it separately, one for one, and then a second prayer for the other.
I'm not sure that they're saying either which way we're going, whether or not it's about bundles and the individual, explicitly. But let's see if they're saying it's okay if you say things, if you say two different ones. Let's see what they say.
I want to make a comment.
Yeah.
Well, it goes against human nature. When you're suffering, and then when it, we know that, we all know that, when it rains, it pours. And in Hebrew, we say, tzarot baot b'tzarot. Mm-hmm. You know that one. Trouble comes in bundles. So you don't get one plague. You get your life is plagued from left to right. And so you can't say, I'm ignoring this and I'll pray just for that. This is against human nature. You say, please God, help. I can't take it anymore. And think of Job. What did Job suffer? Everything. It came in bundles. It's always bundled. So there must be some deep philosophical, because naturally speaking, that's not the case.
Mm.
You pray to be saved from everything.
Okay. So, at least Shmuel Bar Nachmani is going to say to them, they ask, right, Amare, that he is willing to go through the exercise of figuring out which one he's going to pray for when he hears this. Since they said, Lo Esher, it's not possible to pray for two things. He says, okay, fine. Let me say it to you like this then. Eila libaye rachame amotana. Let's pray for the elimination of the deathly plague. V'chafna nisbo. And we'll endure the famine. Right, we'll endure the famine. Rashi adds that he's going to make the calculation. Which is worse? Who dies? Which one kills more people?
Pick your poison.
The chafna nisbo. We're gonna suffer the famine. Amar lahu Rab Shmuel Bar Nachmani. But Rab Shmuel Bar Nachmani says to them again, Ni bayirachame kafna. Let's pray though for the elimination of the famine. The chiyahi rachamana sova. Because when the merciful one provides plenty, right? Lechayehu diyahiv. He provides it for the living, not for the dead. Dichativ. As it's written, You open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. Therefore, if God grants our request to bring an end to the famine and provide plenty, what?
It means we'll be alive to get it.
While you're at it.
Yeah, but this is a setup. I mean, this is so obvious because there are two things that are related in that sense. If you eliminate one, the other will disappear. You know, so, but there could be two totally disparate
things. Plague doesn't disappear because there's food. Food doesn't have any effect on plague.
Right, well.
That's the assertion. That's a logical assertion which may have fallacy. Which may, it may be fleshed.
Now, we're praying here for community things, not individual.
At this point, definitely.
So, you've got something where, is there an implied causality here that the community is not being charitable enough, is not being, not creeping enough misses, or something's causing these things? So the community as a whole has to pray.
Do you see that in the text, Fred?
Nope. I'm just, you know, saying, is this...
No, I did not think that direction, for sure.
Okay.
I thought maybe you saw it.
No, the one thing that occurs to me, though, is both of these things are the kinds of things that are talked about as being sent by God as punishment. Plagues and famines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to other things which can be from a whole bunch of sources. I don't know whether that has any implication here or not.
Right, I mean, these are, unfortunately, by way of sin, there's some resonance here
exactly.
That causation is maybe at hand. I hear it now. Between the two of your construction here, you know, are we talking about not really living up to our part? Well, it's very well, it's possible that, in fact, we're talking about feeling the need to pray because we've taken part in this and we've brought this on based on what we do see in the text. But I don't see it in the text here that they're saying that we necessarily caused these through sin, but I could hear the echo. I could hear the echo. Yeah, now that you...
I mean, these are an existential threat. These aren't just inconveniences.
Yeah.
They're discomforts. If you have famine and plague, I mean, if you, I'm having a bit of an issue here in terms of what is prayer and what's the relationship of man to God. And I mean, if you believe that God is actively participating in your life,
right,
then this seems to be the kind of case where you should be appealing to God for both. I mean, what's the implication if you don't? I mean, eventually you're probably leading us to a little bit of a solution, maybe right ahead. But, I mean, right now I'm just having trouble with logic without understanding why they...
Getting back to what I said earlier, there's a causality attached to it. And the reason you pray for one is because you're trying to create your prayer and focus to create whatever caused it. Like, that takes one, and then you move on to the next, because that may be caused by a different weakness or community action or something. So
yeah.
The reason you pray for one is to focus in on whatever's causing
it. It's interesting that the choice here is not to pray for one and then move on to pray for the other. It is more this inner logical connection that if I pray for this one, then necessarily this one will be taken care of, except that, as Bobby mentioned, we can't necessarily depend on that every time. And so in that vein, the challenge still stands, Jay, that you brought forward, and that is, wait a minute, if we are to rely on God as the ultimate provider of refuah, of parnassah, of healing, of that which is a good living, of makbil l'chol chai ratzon, as this Ashrei verse says, that God, you satisfy every living being, if we are to, you know, kol asher yikruhu ve'emet, we call upon God in truth, and therefore we should be answered, right? It does create the existential problem. And therefore, this piece of prayer philosophy does come as quite a challenge, and it's actually quite shocking.
The problem I'm having with the causality issue is, where's the prescriptive language here that says behave better? In other words,
I don't,
it's all well and good to pray, but if we believe that there's...
I don't think you can read it in a vacuum. I don't think that there's specific causality language right here, though the echo I could hear after what, you know, Fred and Judy suggested to begin with. However, because that's just an ancient way of thinking about the relationship between human beings and the God of heaven, right? That there is some causation and that I can fix that. I can find the tikkun in my more honest-to-goodness prayers, and my fasts should be kapara, that I need some kind of kapara, I need some kind of atonement for this.
No, my point is I don't believe that that's the case, which is why...
I know you don't believe that's the kind of case, but maybe in here that's what they are bringing forward. If they're not, though, and you're suggesting that there's a dilemma because... Why wouldn't God want us to pray for two things at once? God is a benevolent God. God is a God who wants to provide for the world. Why have the plague? Why have the hunger? Right? That is an issue. That is that issue here. And we're trying to find, let's take this as then, the chipus l'derech hanechonah. What is the best way to approach God? On the one hand, it seems like in Masechet Brachot and all over the liturgy, we should bundle things. Maybe this is the alternative, chipus l'derech hachitovah. For the best way forward. Dale.
I have trouble taking this as seriously as this discussion has become, because it's all a trick. The idea that you're only praying for one thing isn't true, and it's almost as if somebody came up with this interpretation of a verse and then created the case by saying you can only pray for one thing.
Okay, so I agree with you that sometimes you can go the direction of saying, you know, like, oh, isn't this quippy?
They're showing off their
isn't this quippy?
Gunslinging.
Right, exactly. It's like gunslinging in the Beit Midrash. Isn't this quippy? Isn't this nice? Because we're about to hear a verse from where they get this notion, and it's just a little bit of fun with the verse. However, the only reason I would say, let's hold out and see, like, get a sense that in their playfulness, they're quite serious. And that's from, like, a Professor Heinemann approach to hermeneutics to begin with, that they wouldn't suggest something in a rabbinic text were it not for being the holiest word game that they ever played in their lives.
And it's
high stakes.
I do know that what you're saying has truth in many cases, but it is so much a trickster response that I can't take it seriously.
I hear you. Okay. So let's look at where the Gemara goes with it and see if there's anything serious.
It's really more to Dale's point is we examine, you know, one little section here, but maybe if we read the whole thing, we'd already know the answer, but we stop and we debate, which is kind of what we do.
Yeah, except that I think it's a more authentic way to read in parts. Think about it from a reception.
That's how it developed.
Right.
Right.
And also think about it from a reception theory point of view. That there's someone in the Beit Midrash who didn't know this next part, just like us. And sometimes the understanding of the text doesn't come until someone, like, you know, brings it on home. It can start from the other direction, by the way. Right? You could be on the inside and know the drash and know which verse is going to be used to say we don't really do this. But in this case, wasn't the way the editor chose to put it out there. For the receiver of the information who's not on the inside, which is why I think it's so great to read text aloud and to stop and say, from, you know, at this point, how does it fall? What does it teach?
Well, because
what's
this was initially taught orally, you have to wonder whether different rabbis had different styles about where they stop and what they elicit and how they go on.
Definitely, right? And who started with, let me tell you about the verse I'm about to drush and give you the verse, and who starts in with the, you know, this is like when three people are at sea. Ah, here's the verse that explains it all. You know. Anyway, so let's go. Gemara inquires. Uminalan de lo matzilenan atarte. From where do we know that we don't pray for two things at the same time? What's the source for that? Ah, there's a verse. Dichtiv v'natsuma univaksham Eloheinu al zot. And we fasted. Natsuma, and here's really one of the reasons why I want to bring this limud up to begin with, because we fasted and we requested from our God concerning this. Miklal de'ika acharite, and the word this implies that there was another need for which they did not pray at the time. So if I pray for zot, I'm not praying for that. In the West, in Eretz Yisrael, they said in the name of Rabbi Chagai that this lesson is derived from the following verse, though. The Rachamim lemid Amy kodam elishmaya al razadana. and to request mercy from the God of heaven concerning what? Razadana, this secret. Miklal de'ika acharite. From this, we understand, it implies that there was another need for which they did not pray at the time. So you have very specific language that said zot or this one, and it's not that one. And getting back to Arthur's comment, you know, hey, while I'm here, would you just take care of that? I'm praying for this, but then. But why is it here in Tanit to begin with? A, because Tanit is all about how I arrange my prayers and whether I say one thing or another at the same time. Mashiv ha-ruach u-morid ha-gashem. I have two different verbs for two different features of nature. Who causes the wind to blow and the rain to fall.
That's like two requests.
Two requests, but said in two with two different verbs. The question that the Gemara might be asking is, should I have a recognition of both of those at once? Because remember, we have a recognition and not a request until we get to Barech, the other blessing. Tain tal umatar, precipitation and the right kind of rains in the seasons? Or shall I only say one? Well, in general, those are natural forces that I could ask for. But when we're challenged with various kinds of dilemmas in life or attacks on our humanity or we have communal problems, maybe we need to make what? Natsuma unevaksha me'elohenu al zot. We need to say there's a very specific reason why we are having this fast and making this request.
Can we have the request without the fast?
Well, you obviously make a lot of requests in prayer, according to Masechet Brachot already, right? One of the aspects of prayer we have is bakashot. So yes, the answer is plainly, you can have requests without a fast.
So why the fast? What is
why the fast? Because this part of the Gemara knows the subsequent Mishnayot that we're going to be learning, and we're going to look at tonight, actually, so that we can get into this whole topic of fasting. This little piece may or may not be waxing philosophically about how we arrange and order our prayers for all the kinds of challenges and, you know, what's a good word for, give me a big umbrella word for things like plague, drought,
adversities,
disasters, adversity, right?
As a big no, I don't know why tonight. This logic here,
stirring you up.
The logic, because it says al zot. I mean, to me, what that implies is there's one thing. So they're saying you can infer from that there's something else they're not praying.
I don't get that. Either.
But the source from Ezra is what I just checked.
Open it up.
It's just one thing. So I mean,
so read it.
Move guy. I'm happy to read it.
It didn't have GPS.
Well, we have to start. Okay.
I proclaimed
the fast there by the Ahava River to afflict ourselves before our God, to beseech him for a smooth journey for us and for our children, for all our possessions, because they're being pursued. For I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us against any enemy on the way, since we had told the king the benevolent care of our God is for all who seek him, while his fierce anger is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and he responded to our plea. There's just the one thing they're praying for. So this inference that there's something else they're not praying for, I don't know what...
It is a typical use of a verse. That I will admit to.
Yeah.
Right. They're not concerned that the Peshat, thank you for bringing the Ezra, because we were just about to go to the Ezra in my handy pocket tonight.
I didn't want to take out my phone and have you think I was on my phone. I could have looked there too.
The world today has changed, Jay. The Davka Tanakh lives right here. But Jay read the passage that's very important to understand. Again, doubling down on why this is here and why we need this little passage. It's kind of a bridge to the world of fasting that's going to come in Mishnayot 4, 5, 6, 7, in the first chapter of Tanit. because we're going to move from that liturgy discussion we had with Mashiva Ruach and Miragashim and all those powers, and the day of rain is like as holy as this, and the day of rain doesn't come because of all these sins, right? We're really kind of, this is an anchor, this is a fulcrum, you know, the table's going to now, you know, and it's going to move towards this other topic. And it's not going to get there for a little while, but we're going to page ahead. The Ezra source is so interesting because it shows you how deeply the rabbis are into Midrash. Dale, you said it a different way. It's a typical use of a verse, right? They don't have to read the pshat. They don't have to read it only as they are praying for the journey of those to get back to Eretz Yisrael. There is something else. Now, you could project the drash back on to Sefer Ezra, or in this case, Ezra Nehemiah, and the passage about Ezra, and go and say, well, what else could it have been that they didn't pray for? But we don't have to do that. We can leave the pshat of Ezra as having asked for only one thing. The important part of what we've got in terms of the surfacing of the hypertext on a literary level is that, oh, I know Ezra, who was the one who made the takanot to actually have public Torah readings, to actually have public gatherings of prayer services, who was important to start the Anshei Knesset Hagadolah, those who are likened as the earliest fathers who wrote liturgy for our prayer services, and who understand that within kind of within the system and as part of the religious experience of the Jewish people, you're going to have set prayers, and you're also going to have that kind of kavanah-filled rachameh, that prayer you need at a given moment for a certain journey, which, by the way, we seem to have lost a little within our prayer traditions, right? There's not a lot of spontaneous prayers for people going on their journey by fellows, or calling for days of fast vis-a-vis one or another real problems in our midst. We don't tend to have those as communities, whether it's Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox. In Israel, the tradition...
You do have the but you don't fast.
No, but it's fixed. But it's fixed. What I'm suggesting is that we've lost this kind of spontaneous notion of praying for any given need, any given facing adversity, any disaster that we have, except to say, again, there have been gatherings. Drought has happened. People are asked to come and say Tehillim together, say Psalms together, for facing that kind of notion of a drought. But I think, again, here, we get this, don't ask for one thing or another, because we want to name a certain calamity. We want to name a certain adversity. We want to name a certain disaster in order to declare a fast. And then to have a fast and to know what we're fasting around and to know what we're requesting from God, and that we generally can say one thing is enough. I don't think it's saying don't pray for two things at once as much as it's saying even if you have one thing you need to ask from God, you need to ask and pray for, declare that fast, gather your people, and make that prayer authentically happen as we have in Israel since the time of Ezra at this point that we read the drush and we see the verse.
I just had the thought, maybe I'm wrong because it doesn't say it here, that the typical ancient thinking was that every transgression gets its own punishment. So it's like the crime and the punishment match. So if
and it's one-to-one.
If you get Dever, the plague, it's because you transgressed on this one, while the famine is the punishment. So it's sort of punishment-specific, crime-specific. And maybe that's what we have here. So segregate the two different things and make you think of what do this punish, what are you being punished for? But maybe there was a book of a list of things. I don't, It's not in this text, but it's...
Yeah. Could be. Could be, again, that it is related to punishments, sins and punishments. I fully agree that, that this is part of the ancient consciousness and spiritual consciousness. And again, on the notion of what the Gemara is doing here, on a textual, building a text basis, which I like to look at it, I like to look at it in that kind of philological way, I think here we have the introduction of the topic of fasting, yeah. And that the notion that a fast can be linked to one topic, and that it's about a calamity that is communal. Whoever said that it is communal here, we're facing a communal calamity. And we're going to see in a minute, through some Mishnayot later in the chapter, that this topic that's introduced here in this way is now going to be built upon. And we're going to have this Masechet Tanit not deal with just, you know, if you will, just 8 pages, 7 pages of Mashiva Ruach and Merid Hagashem and liturgy and the Amidah. We're now going to move into communal fasting and talking about really pouring our hearts out in prayer for our needs as a community.
So I have a problem. You have a famine. So whose idea is, let's fast to solve the famine?
Oh, that's it. I would say, Ron, that I expected you to have that problem.
Whose idea is that?
I have one more comment. The chief, many years ago, there was a terrible accident. The school bus turned over, and many the school kids got killed. I don't remember the details, and I think it was a religious school. I'm not sure.
Yeah, in the train crash, the train go over the bus.
Something, right? It was very bad.
It was an Orthodox
and
school.
And there was a big, yeah.
Are we going to the mezuzah case?
Yeah, the mezuzah case. Yeah.
Exactly, and the outcry was, go check the mezuzahs in the country, because so that was like a.
No, it didn't start like that. The rabbi said that it's because.
Wait, why are we relating to that story though? Tell me what the relation is.
42 people got killed.
I know, tragedy. What's the relationship to here?
So it's punishment.
Oh, you mean the response being check your mezuzah. You're thinking about that as being like a response to a calamity seems to be...
One of the mezuzah of those families was not kosher.
Yeah, so I think this is a little different in terms of just introducing the whole topic of choosing to fast and pray versus blaming a non-kosher mezuzah and getting to that level of magic. I think it's about really supplications that really want to move God in a theurgic sense. It's true if you want to call that a little bit on the religious magical thinking spectrum. I wouldn't disagree if we were in a scholarly class about what we're asking God to do and how our actions down below create movement within God, the Godhead, that there is theurgical kind of underpinnings that we as the prayers can move God to act based on our actions here. But if I wasn't going to think about it in a scholarly way and I was going to think about it spiritually, I would say that if I identify a certain adversity, a certain sense of oncoming disaster, and I declare a public day of prayer and fasting, and I decide that because as a community, it is really an ancient inheritance that we deprive ourselves of something to really hope that we can influence God. And also I think, and this is where I'll argue, that spirituality really is about the building up of our personal capacities to impact results in the world. I think that concentration, deep concentration, spiritual concentration on individual kinds of problems in the world most likely moved at least one or two people in the community to take deeper action, to take more focused action at the very least, about those given problems. And I think the same works today, by the way. It works very much the same. So we don't declare a fast per se, but some people come and they pray, and they're working in the world, and they're the ones responsible for some aspect of research, And now and then you'll see someone comes into the shul and says, I just need this 50 minutes of shacharit to really focus me and ask for God's strength when it comes to fulfilling my mission today in a science lab. Right? I'm using that as only limashah. And a lot of people have that. You know, somebody before the great recital that they were going to do on their saxophone for the arts high school, you know, I never see him, but one day he needs to come and declare that this day of prayer is going to give me the strength I need to do this, because it's a way of self-reflection, it's a way of taking an accounting, and it's a way of organizing the strength we have, but it's also connected very deeply to God. Blaming it on a faulty mezuzah, and a not kosher mezuzah, that there should be a tragedy of that proportion, is embarrassing in terms of the tradition. Right?
But
it's just embarrassing.
The concept, though, that somebody sinned and therefore the community is punished is not foreign to the tradition.
It's not foreign to the ancient, tradition, mm-hmm. And it's not foreign to a certain, what I would call, theodicy.
Yes.
Acceptance of a certain definition of theodicy within our tradition among segments of our people ad hayom hazeh, to this very day, right? Sin causes the Holocaust, is the worst of them all. This is the worst claim, which was embarrassing to even
yes.
Orthodox authorities, who would say that quid pro quo simply doesn't work. That is not theology that we accept as mainstream Judaism, if you will.
Yeah, Rav Ovadia, the Debbie guy, said Shoah, the Holocaust happened because of Gilgul Neshamot Shel Anashim Shechatu. This is unbelievable. It was
reincarnation of.
I don't know. I always said Gilgul Neshamot.
Reincarnation, isn't it?
So I would say it like this. There's a doctrine of the reincarnation of souls, and that souls come back to the world to ultimately fulfill their missions and redeem great sparks and bring about the ultimate redemption of the world.
This is Kabbalistic.
It's originally Zoharic and maybe has some precedent in strata before that the Zohar even becomes literature.
Rabbi Ovadia Yosef
is the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel, who was among those who, according to Ron's reportage here, claimed that certain souls that were back in the world at this given generation who were sinning needed to be exterminated. Now, how he would ever make that point and get away with the notion that they should pay with their lives ba'olam hazeh, in this world, I really don't understand that theology, and I really don't understand his major claim. I've only read a little.
Me too.
But...
Well, we can reject things.
Yeah, exactly. There's a certain point where, you know, yesh gvul, there's a boundary. It's not foreign to us, to get back to Dale's point. It's not foreign to us that sin causes calamity. Nonetheless, I think that the calling upon the community to engage in prayer and fasting would hopefully encourage God to really play God's part in history. And if you want the philosophical, you know, nature there, that God plays a role in history is definitely part and parcel of how Jewish people have thought about God, that God is an actor in history, and that we want there to be history filled with more kedusha and possibility for the world than destruction and devastation and calamity. And two, I believe we're talking about, and this is to answer really your question, why would we call for a fast at all? Because people need a deeper concentration and a deeper sense of spiritual connection to the challenges we face in this world and the sufferings of this world as we know them. And one of our responses is not only prayer as we know it in the typical liturgies, but was especially for our ancestors, and could still be for us, a more responsive set of deprivation kind of practices that are not completely ascetic, but really get into this notion of how fasting and prayer are linked and what it means for us as physical human beings to have this spiritual attainment in our lives. And that's why I want you to now turn, and I want to look at some of these Mishnayot together, and I want to get into this topic of fasting within Tanit, and then, as I said, expand on it a little through some of the other sources that I brought to deepen our sense of why fast? What was it linked to? What was the root of fasting within the tradition? And how does it really, quote-unquote, work? And even answer some questions about who's supposed to fast on these various fast days that we're going to talk about. Because through Mishnayot in chapter 1 and a couple of places in chapter 4 in Tanit, which I really want to make sure we get to, so I'm going to bring it in through looking at it as parallel Mishnayot to some of these Mishnayot that talk about fasting. We're going to go look at the historical fasts of Israel and what reasons are attached to some of the fasts that we know, like 17 Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, which come in chapter 4 later. So I want to get to those places, and I want to expand our thinking about fasting in general by looking at these other sources. Okay, so here we go. 10A3. So turn to 10A3, or Yud Aleph, to the Mishnah that begins, Higia Yud Zayin B'Mar Cheshvan. All right? We there? The Mishnah on 10a. Higia Yud Zayin B'Mar Cheshvan. So we are going to connect it to the 17th day of Mar Cheshvan.
10a3, did you say?
10a3 is where the Mishnah is. See the Mishnah there?
It's in B'Shrusha B'Mar Cheshvan Shualim.
Higia Yud Zayin B'Mar Cheshvan is the one I'm on.
Okay, right.
10a3.
Right.
You there?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Higia Yud Zayin B'Mar Cheshvan. The 17th day of Mar Cheshvan arrives. V'lo yadu geshamin. And rain has not come yet. Hitchilu ha'yichidim mit'anin gimel ta'aniot. Shalosha ta'aniot. The distinguished individuals of the community begin to fast three fasts. Now, what does that mean? The Gemara ruled on 6 that if the expected time of the third rainfall eventually passes, certain very important individuals from the community begin to fast, and therefore our Mishnah, which states that the fast commences after the 17th of Mar Cheshvan, accords with the opinion of Rabbi Meir, who gives the date as the expected time of the third rain. Keep your finger there, just to go back to 6a, if you want to go, you don't have to. We're going to see. It was taught in a Braita on 6a2 for those who went there. Yorei b'mar cheshvan u'malkosh b'nisan. The Torah promises that Yorei will fall in mar cheshvan and malkosh in Nisan. Remember, we had these different kinds of rains. Divrei Rabbi Meir, v'chokhamim omrim, Yorei v'kislev. Yorei is in Kislev. Beginning rains, end rains. And who, man chachamim, who are the sages? Rav Chista said, Rav Yossi taught that, for it was taught in the Braita. What's the time of the first rainfall this season? The first rainfall descends on the 3rd of Mar Cheshvan, the intermediate one on the 7th of Mar Cheshvan, the last one on the 17th of Mar Cheshvan. The words of Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Yehuda Omer, v'shivav, v'yud zayin besrim u'shlosha, the first rain falls on the 7th of Mar Cheshvan, the intermediate on the 17th, and the last one on the 23rd. Rabbi Yossi says that b'yud zayin v'esrim v'shlosha v'rosh chodesh kislev, so they're talking about dates of the first and the intermediate and then the last rains. And then Rabbi Yossi used to say, ein hayichidim mitanin, when no rain falls, the devout individuals do not begin fasting, ad sheyagia rosh chodesh kislev. And so you have this notion of fasts. And what are the fasts? They're held on the following Monday and Thursday and the Monday after that. So you have three fasts that are responsive to the lack of rain as a response to the, I'm going to say it by way of God's perspective, the withholding of rain from Yisrael. Because I want to have that overlay as well. They did believe that God withheld this rain. But if no rain comes and you just are thinking about it as a natural phenomenon, because who knows what all the people were thinking at the same time, that, oh, there's not this natural phenomenon in the world, something's got to spark it up, and maybe the fasts do that. So it's either connected to, I got to make amends for all the wrongs I did, because it's punishment sin theology, or I am a kind of person who says, wait a minute, the natural order is not working right, I have to do something that's going to start up God to really send this rain in its season. Theurgically, what's that something I need to do? It's beyond the natural prayers. I better fast. It goes Monday, Thursday, Monday, after the 17th of Cheshvan, that I make three fasts. All right? And we should be asking ourselves, what does it mean by three fasts? Am I talking about Yom Kippur kind of fasts? Right? We learned that last year together, Yoma. Am I talking Yom Kippur fasts? No, we learned Pesachim. We learned 2 years ago, Yoma. Am I talking about the kind of fast that I know from other fasts that are around in our tradition, meaning the daytime fasts that are four times a year? Right? Because those are fasts that are, in terms of my Jewish literacy, I kind of have in my mind too, the 10th of Tevet and the Yudzayin of Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz. Ah, so, like, which fasts are they? Didn't answer that in this Braita. Right? So that's a holdout question, and I'm bringing it up simply because you have to be thinking about these kind of practical things as you hear people are doing things within our tradition. But, okay, back to 10a3 and our Mishnah. So, Hitchilu ha'yichidim itanin gimel taniyot, that's when the individuals begin to fast those three fasts. Now, instructional about the fasts. Ochlin v'shotin, mi shechashecha, they may eat and drink after nightfall on the eve of that fast. Umutarin b'melacha, and on the fast day, they are permitted to engage in work. Uverichitza, and in washing themselves. Uvesicha, and in anointing themselves. Uvenilata sandal, in the wearing of leather shoes. Uvetashmish hamita, and in carnal relations, marital relations. Now, why do I have those particular kind of permission? Because I have Yom Kippur in the back of my mind. If it said they begin 3 days of fasting, I might have said to myself that obviously that means it's 3 days of fasting like Yom Kippur fasting. Not the case. What I say is, it's not like that at all. Explicitly in the Mishnah it says, I don't have to worry about any of those prohibitions. This isn't Inui Nefesh in the same way. Remember, we had the Inui Nefesh, La'anot Enafshotechem. That was Yom Kippur. Here we have different kinds of standards. By the way, what does marital relations really mean? Literally, it says on the bottom, Rashi says, the use of the bed, although the activities enumerated in the Mishnah are prohibited on the fasts of Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, right? Because I also had to keep Tisha B'Av in mind. They are permitted on these less stringent fast days, Rashi. And do I permit any kind of tashmish amita? Am I talking about any kind of that night going in and having marital relations? Some authorities seem to say by the Rishonim that I have permission to do any of it because ultimately my fast really isn't starting and the Mishnah permitted it. And why not? Because we are people who have that kind of pleasure in this world and in this life, and then the next day you're going to fast. Okay, that's the next day. It's not tonight. Why should I start fasting now, right? Other authorities say it's only if she has the obligation to go to the mikveh that night and comes home from the mikveh, and you have the absolute obligation of reuniting in that marital way, of coming to the marital bed. So that's just an interesting halachic little, let's say, foray in terms of any of the particulars about fasting itself. But what's interesting is it didn't tell you, though, neither in the Braita on page 6 that we went back to, or here in this Mishnah, exactly how the decision was made, except to say that we have this general rule that if it didn't come in Yuzayin, and did the person himself have to make any kind of declaration? I will add simply from the knowledge that we will get some discussion about how one really takes this on. Do I have to say it out loud? Do I have to not say it out loud? Do I only have to think it? I'm fasting tomorrow. Who has to know? Do I have to tell my spouse? Or do I have to tell my friend? Or do I have to tell a minion of people? What does it mean to take that on? Who are the chashuvim, by the way? Who are the most important people? Because I talked about it being the important people of the town, the chassidim, the pious ones. Who are they? How did we make those distinctions? So some of that comes into focus, even though I have no mention again of these kind of particulars.
So they say that mutar b'melacha, that means I'm allowed to go to work.
That's right.
So if I'm going to work and I'm busy 8 hours in work, when I'm going to pray for the specific request for God.
Oh, okay. So maybe, first of all, that you don't have 8 hours of work. Second of all, maybe it's talking about only melacha that you have to get done that day, even though you've taken on a fast, so that you don't have a hefsed, so that you don't have a loss. So again, the diuk about that, is your question is exactly right. Does it mean that I should go to work for 8 hours a day and be there, and while I'm not eating or drinking,
it's a communal
it's enough?
Prayer, because
it's
we want
not,
to solve a communal problem.
It's
so.
Not a communal prayer.
Here, it's right now just in the context of a personal fast of not eating and drinking. But you're asking a good Jewish question. Do they mean I can go to work for 8 hours a day? Or does it mean that I can do necessary malacha so that I don't have a loss?
Almost akin to Ramadan, to an Islamic fast, where they can eat at night, mm-hmm. and they during the day they go to work and they still fast.
Did Islam as a religion take from the ancient practice?
Yeah, there was more variety. Take from the fast, and I always thought we were very different from
no,
Ramadan,
no, no.
but not so different.
No, no, but Ramadan is an outgrowth of how we set fasts in motion in the ancient world.
Yeah, yeah.
To think about fasting as Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur for us, and that being our fast versus a Ramadan fast, is to fall in line with, let's say, a 19th and a 20th century experience of fasting in Jewish communities that are, you know, let's say, from anywhere from Reform to Conservative to Reconstructionist to, you know, if you will, the liberal of the modern age. But someone who's intent on fasting for the other fasts during the year has more fasts that look like what you're considering the Ramadan fast than there is a full fast for Yom Kippur, because people in a community where they're fasting for the 10th of Tevet, the 17th of Tammuz, the 3rd of Tishrei after Rosh Hashanah. What's that?
Well,
Esther's a little bit different in terms of this grouping, but Tani Esther is also morning to sunset, so that fits into that as well. And if you really take seriously the fast of the firstborn, and you didn't make a siyum before Passover, so you have more fasts that look like sunrise to sunset, let's eat, in Judaism on a yearly basis, than you do have full 25-hour or 24-hour fasts in the tradition. And Ramadan, as fasting practices go, was, if you will, a direct outgrowth of ancient fasting practices that continued along in the Jewish tradition. And that's why the whole meeting of religious folks who were benevolent or gracious towards each other in 8th to 11th century, let's say, Cairo or the Middle East, they looked at each other as being, you know, very, very much in the groove, you know? And those kinds of practices spoke a rootedness to the same shoresh, to the same root of these kinds of spiritual practices that could make a difference in life.
The Muslim invite for the dinner at night guests.
Right, right. In several communities, that's true. I just heard an incredible story. You know that there are Muslims keeping Ramadan from all kinds of Muslim communities from throughout the world, right? We're not only talking about Arabs when we talk about Islamic communities, right? Muslim communities. So we're talking about the Albanians in Staten Island. We're talking about the
lots of Albanians in Manhattan.
Also in Manhattan. These folks are so open and gracious when it comes to inviting all of the rabbis when we have these interfaith gatherings.
Yeah.
That it's really incredible that they have this tradition. By us, if you fast and you're finishing your fast and you're in shul, you hear mincha, the Haftarah, you quickly daven Maariv, and you run to eat something, and you chop a quick meal. But that's really it. Like, we don't have a kind of celebration surrounding days of fast, except for breakfast at Yom Kippur, when generally it's a more communal kind of experience than inviting guests kind of experience.
The Ramadan is 40 days, correct?
No.
Yeah, it's 1 month.
But they haven't figured their calendar out yet, so they get really screwed when it's in. We worked down in Texas, the Libyan, and he'd be out. We were there in August of the year that it fell in August. He was out in the oil field 6 in the morning till sundown wasn't until about 9 o'clock at night.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was out there working all...
Do they make any... they didn't make any kind of special...
Where it falls, you know, it's
I don't
sooner.
Know.
Like exceptions because it was so hot, or?
Oh no, there was no one to make the exception. He was his own boss. There wasn't anyone to make an exception for him. But I'm just saying. But you know, when it happens in December, you have a few hours you have to pass.
Very interesting. Okay, so that was that beginning of that Mishnah. Turn the page if you're on 10A4 now. Let's keep going here. Higia Rosh Chodesh Kislev V'lo Yardu Gishamim. And now if the first day of the month of Kislev arrived, right? Imagine how long that is. Right? You're supposed to see rains definitely in Mar Cheshvan already, right? Now it's Kislev, there hasn't been any rain. Beit Din Gozrin Shalosh Taniot Alat Sibor. So, you just said it wasn't on the entire public. Here's the entire public has to get involved. The Beit Din comes and says, we're now going to have 3 fasts on the community. Ochlim v'shotim mishechashicha, they may eat and drink after nightfall on the eve of the fasts. Umutarin bimlacha, you are permitted to engage in work. Uverechitza uvesicha, in bathing and anointing. Uvenilat sandal, and wearing leather shoes. Uvetashmishamita, and in marital relations. So that is the Mishnah there. Turn, I want us to see the other couple of Mishnayot on the same topical level. So we're going to page through for a second and do Mishnayot. It'll take us back to do bits and parts of Sugiyas when we return to some of these. The next Mishnah is on page 12b2.
Avru,
yeah.
Avru. I
need
my class.
Yeah. A dalet and a resh can be very close, you know. The greatest of sofrim can make that kind of mistake in the Torah, and then we have to scrape one out and put the resh in. So, no worries. As a matter of fact, did you ever hear that the tradition of making a dalet with what hangs over the top became a tradition? Because we used to have this notion that a dalet should kind of come up like this and then be written like this. But it looks so close to a resh that what we decided in the Ushrit script was that it was going to have its own little part that's kind of like squared off above what is the shape of a vav, of a post, a smaller vav. It's a shorter vav, so that we could really make the distinction, because people were all the time
confusing
the letters. Okay.
Were we on the first Avru?
Yeah, the first Avru. Avru Elu Velo Nanu. If these first 3 public fasts passed and they were not answered with rain, Beit Din Gozrin, Shloshet Haniyot Acherot Al Tzibor, now there's going to be 3 other fasts on the community. Right? Didn't, by the way, what could it have said, just given our past history now? Yeah, the first 3 fasts were your Hasidim. The next 3 fasts were on the Tzibor. Who might it have been? The next 3 fasts could have been?
Everybody.
Could be everybody, or it could go back to? Your Hasidim. So just again, possibilities. Ochlin v'shotin mibod yom. They may eat and drink on the eve of that fast, only while it's still day. But after sunset, they don't eat. So what does that mean? Now we get a little sense of how this system worked. It actually, by way of taking on the fast, or the decree, comes, and miba'ol yom, on that day that the decree comes, and that you have to fast with the tzibor, you can eat, up to when? Up to sunset. Va'asarim bimlacha, and they're prohibited from engaging in work. Uva rechitza, and washing oneself. Uva sicha, and anointing oneself. Uva ne'ilata sandal, and wearing shoes. Uva tashmisha mita, and in marital relations. V'no'olim et ha'merchatzaod, and they lock the bathhouses.
They make it
like Yom Kippur. They literally make it like Yom Kippur. Now, those three pass. Avru, Elu, Velonanu. Those three pass and they're not answered. Beit Din goes Rinalehin Od Sheva. The Beit Din says we now have to take on seven fasts. Shehen Yud Gimel Taniot Alatzibor. So that they are a total of 13 fasts incumbent upon the community. So if you ever thought in the tradition that Yud Gimel was the Midot Shel Rachamim, the compassionate aspects of God, Yud Gimel 13 was the age of Bar Mitzvah. Now you have a new 13. Why is 13 really important in the tradition? 13 fasts if there's no rain. 13 fasts if there's no rain. Hare Elu Yeteirot Ala Rishonot. These last seven fasts are more stringent than even the first six ones. Sheba Elu Matriin. For on those seven fasts, they cry out. What are they crying out? The Gemara is going to discuss what really is crying out. And it's on those seven. So maybe Ron was right. Maybe it meant on those days, you did have a fast to make, right? You weren't eating, you weren't drinking. But you were in the oil field. You were in the field. Over here already, if there's nothing, we haven't gotten the rain, and now we need seven to make the 13, that's the time when I really bring people in and I say, no, 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 it's a day off for you. Let's go. We need you for a minyan. For Noelin et hachanuyot, they lock the stores. You are not allowed as a store owner to go in and take care of your business. Basheni matinim chashicha. On Monday, they partially open the doors of the food stores toward the evening. Uvachamishi mutarim mipnei kechavod haShabbat. And on Thursday, they're permitted to open the stores the entire day because of the honor of the Sabbath. So they work out this systemic way of having seven public days of fasting and making sure that people have enough food for...
On the Monday, Thursday, it's not in a row.
Right, Monday, Thursday, not in a row. They would not do that. But inherent in what your observation
quite
is,
punishing.
Right, it is still quite punishing. Inherent in your observation, though, is wouldn't it be cruel if it was otherwise? Like, now we're gonna.
Oh, this is so, you know, and I now, you know, I would like to when we're finished talk about why in the 19th and 20th century there was a move away from this kind of personal and much more frequent fasting. So I'm trying to see what it was to understand what was moved away from and what was lessened.
Well, this kind of personal fasting, there's already a great move away from it much earlier on. 19th and 20th century, there's a move away from even fasting on what we consider to be the minor fast days. And I think that they're two different categories, just to hold out for a minute and think about each of those as two very different categories. And the answers probably are very different for each of them, right? That these fasts, as you're intimating, are really kind of difficult. Though there are people in the frum world who take on fasting for the sins of Israel on Mondays and Thursdays and Mondays and Thursdays and Mondays and Thursdays and Mondays and Thursdays.
All the time.
And you'll have explanations within a book that the Luach, like the standard Luach, what Parsha is at the Shabbat, what time's candle lighting, what do you do for this holiday, what do I need to think about or remember to get for Shul. And in the Luach, they'll have, you know, this cycle of Monday, Thursday, Monday fast starts for those who are pious and keeping Am Yisrael alive and well and fasting for the sins of our brothers. To that point, to that level of like kind of what they consider to be spiritual seriousness, right? That's a little bit, if, yeah, that to me seems a little overdone. And
daytime only, though.
Yeah, daytime only fast, not the level of this kind of either parallel to Yom Kippur or even beyond that, that an entire community decides to lock stores and forbid work in a community and this kind of approach. However, there are those who do feel that this practice, which is semi-aesthetic and yet connected to community because you're not doing anything different from the activities of the Beit Midrash, vis-a-vis the davening in the minyan, learning with everybody else, and that you're really getting up early enough to have your own cup of coffee and breakfast, and then you're fasting for the day, and you break the fast at night, and it's kind of like you do that with a chevra who's fasting. Right? For them, it becomes very communal, and in and of itself, as a practice, if I don't connect it to the sins and the spiritual work that they associate it with, it kind of like makes for a next level of mitzvah that is for them very community building. And the reason why I think we have to see it in that light, as well as, wow, it sounds a little bit harsh and a little bit much, is that they're always looking for ways to create small community within community because of the great need for people to build community and camaraderie.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, after how many fasting days Jacob decided to go to Egypt?
Are you remembering a passage where it said Jacob
fasted?
No,
I mean, he went to Egypt. He didn't go through the whole punishment.
Wait, are you suggesting that Jacob actually knew the Mishnah?
Everything is flipped.
No, Ron, there are those who would say Jacob knew the Mishnah, so did Abraham, so did Isaac.
So when he decided to go to Egypt, it's easier.
I don't know what the tzibor was at that time.
It's a good klutz kasha.
Yeah,
but it's factual. They didn't bring any reference to Jacob.
It's a good klutz kasha. You know what a klutz kasha is?
I know what klutz kasha is. It's good to ask those questions.
Yeah, good. All right, let's see what the next level of this is. There's one more level to the Mishnah, 12b3. Avru elu velo na'alu. But no, I'm sorry. Avru elu velo na'anu. If these latter seven fasts pass and they were not answered yet, Mimatin b'masavamatan, they should decrease their involvement in commerce. The Gemara doesn't clarify the ruling. Footnote. Magen Avraham perceives a connection between this ruling and the one that follows in the Mishnah. Thus, since the Gemara limits the restriction on construction of those projects of a joyful nature, normal business activity would be permitted. So we're talking about, what are we really talking about? They, as a community, if they're really not answered, should kind of postpone the basic answer, and we'll read it inside, is they should kind of postpone all the stimchas.
Postpone clothes. Binyan, netiyah, erusin.
All these kinds of things. They're going to postpone all kinds of things. Bivinyan of netiyah, they should not continue to have construction there and in planting the fields. Be'erusin of nisuin, they shouldn't have these celebrations for betrothing and marrying. Uvashe lot shalom ben adam chaviro, in greeting one another in the typical way. That they really have to change their entire attitude, if you will. Rather, they should act kivnei adam hanizufin lamakom, as people who are censured by the omnipresent. Hayechidin, the distinguished individuals, chozrin umitanin, they resume fasting, ad sheyetze Nisan, until Nisan departs. Yatza Nisan vayardu geshamim, if rain fell after the month of Nisan had ended, siman klala, the rain is a sign of curse. Shenemar, halo katzir chetim hayom, is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to Hashem and he will send thunder and rain, that you may know and see that your wickedness is great. Now, this is a drama that's being charted out in the Mishnah to say that A, punishment sin theology, sin punishment theology is alive and well. But moreover, a community that beseeches God, that doesn't have an answer, they are taking on a certain spiritual overtone and a spiritual drama that puts them all, quote unquote, in the same boat. And they're saying, as a community, we are in this together. Doesn't say everyone picks up their belongings and goes to a community where they have more rain. They leave for the diaspora. They're kind of in this together to try to solve some type of problem and issue. And I think the drama is about that notion of the yechidim, the chassidim, the chashuv people, the very important people of the community. In this case, yes, they had a certain place to start the fasting, but then everyone in the community was involved, meaning whoever was defined by the word tzibor. The public is involved in taking on that responsibility spiritually. And, you know, let's take the worst case scenario. No rain, not answered, Nisan comes, dry season stays, it doesn't even have any rain. Well, that may be a part of the natural cycle of drought, and we have to recover from that, and we know we have to recover from that. What they see as the klala, as the curse, is rain in the wrong season. And that drives them to be thinking about their relationship to their understanding of Torah, their understanding of tradition, their understanding of ethical ways of behaving. Remember, we read enough. We didn't read all those pages now because I wanted us to get through these Mishnah. We read enough to say they really thought rain was being withheld because of many different types of sins. And among those sins are Bein Adam L'Makom issues, between God and human being, God and human beings, and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, and ethical kinds of behavioral issues, sages to sages, sages to everyday kind of townsfolk, and regular good old folk among themselves in terms of business practices. So this language that God should just visit punishments upon you because you have a sullied sin and you've a sullied soul because of sin, that's not the real point of that even theology within our tradition, in my estimation. Because all the time we have this talk about these relationships between God and people, and between Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, between people and fellow human beings, and the ethics that are supposed to be regulating the kind of interactions we have. This drama was case in point, another way to bridge the individuals who had clout, yet the entire tzibur, to put us all in the same boat and bring everyone to it and accede to authority of locking the stores and only opening the storehouses at a certain time and agreeing to certain traditions as a community that would get us in the mode of really feeling like we did have some say or role in bringing about blessing to the earth. And that, I think, is at the core of the tradition when it comes to these fasts. So far, that's what the drama about fasting says. And we'll see even more in some other areas from the Gemara and from texts that I've brought on this great package of sources. So, Ad Kan, does that catch you anywhere new? Does that catch you anywhere new? You know, now that we've heard the end of the drama. That's the end of the drama, right?
Right. It. And I think that psychologists, nutritionists, people today would feel that if you do this regularly, you're getting into an unhealthy kind of deprivation and whatever, and it becomes kind of ascetic and self-punishing. Mm-hmm. And I see it as the kinds of things that went into Christianity in the Middle Ages too, where this kind of using the body to be an expression of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it seems not a healthy approach. And I do think that Judaism is filled with bonding opportunities, particularly for males. It's three times a day, it's prayer, it's all kinds of things. So if you ask me, I wouldn't recommend a new bonding thing that has kind of questionable benefits
right.
in terms of a mental and a physical outlook, because when there is a lot of fasting, and we have this with anorectic people, it changes the body chemistry, it changes the mental wiring, and it's not such a healthy thing. So that's my...
I hear you. So on this level of the practice really not being widespread and popular, I think you've said a lot to show why it may not have stuck, right? Because of either comparisons to what other faiths did with fasting, either like the Christianity and some Christian practices that you're making reference to. I'm not sure exactly of which traditions you're referencing, but I for sure deprivation became part and parcel. Even the Ramadan we were talking about before, with respect, you know, concentrating a month long of this, that was not our way of ever coming up with a spiritual approach. And these 3 days of fasting, or three sets of 3 days, or 13 fasts, not typical through the ages, not really continued in very, very popular ways. It's not, it may be hyperbolic to say that certain halakha even becomes popular, but it's not in the popular halakha volumes that were produced by the World Zionist Organization, 3-volume set, to have these kinds of fasts.
Two questions. Can we assume it went out with the Beit Din? Is that really the Sanhedrin?
Like with the Sanhedrin?
Yeah.
I mean, there.
And then the other question is, would it apply only in Israel?
Yeah, so there's a thought that, A, we are talking only about Israel. B, that the Beit Din in Bavel, and there's some kind of thinking about, this is in the Babylonian Talmud, so was there some writing or mapping Eretz Yisrael onto the Babylonian diaspora, and by that even allowing for certain of the practices that we would do in the land to be part and parcel of what we did, especially when it came to Parnassa and agriculture and all we were involved with in our diasporic existence. And so with this one, the answer could be a very flat, it only applies to Eretz Yisrael, and if that was the case, the Babylonian Talmud, why does it do this? Only for the record of it, or because there was a Beit Din that felt that they had the authority to actually decree these kinds of things in the diaspora? To the first point, what was the first point you made, though?
The Sanhedrin.
Right, the Sanhedrin itself. Who was the Beit Din? So that's a big question when it says Beit Din. Are we only referring to Sanhedrin when it says the Beit Din? Or are we talking about the more local Beit Din? And which Beit Din did have the authority? And again, was it only Eretz Yisraeli, or did the Beit Din in Babel have any authority? So you could say we're only talking about Ha Beit Din, but then why didn't it say the Sanhedrin? Right, so the answer would be it doesn't say the Sanhedrin, and so we're not talking about only the Sanhedrin. That we could be talking about a Beit Din that has the samchut, that has the authority.
But I think there are places where the Sanhedrin is called Beit Din.
Yeah, you could say that the words are used interchangeably, but it doesn't particularly say Rak HaSanhedrin, or the Sanhedrin has to affirm this, or it's got to be a court of all those who sit on the Sanhedrin, or have certain numbers. It simply says Beit Din, Yichoriz.
Just one other comment. In an agricultural community, if you don't have rain, this is not a bad way to stretch out the food. You know, it's a very practical thing, because eventually you're going to not be eating anyway.
Right. Your managing of the storehouses could really be part and parcel of why you had any of these systems and togetherness about them. And the management of storehouses, if you recall, remember I brought, I don't know if maybe you were not in the Beit Midrash that day, but do you remember we studied a little bit about Rabbi Yehuda's management of the grain houses during the time of famine, which I think very much relates to this, again, intertextually, which you've brought forward and saw it. That text that we learned, he had students teach him about the general ethics, if you remember, of what it meant to have hungry people around and how he should open the storehouses a little bit more. And here we have a system worked out where you have it open on the Monday and you have it open again on the Thursday, and it seems to be very regulated by way of the entire community having enough. So I do think you've hit on a really wonderful ethical issue that arises out of this, which is it relates very much to how you manage short supplies of food.
So we are punished by having no rent for such a long period of time. And Beth Din decide to punish the people more but not allowing them to have family growth, expanding family, netiot or building houses for the community to grow. So it's a double punishment on an issue that we are already being punished.
Yeah, perhaps it's about perhaps it's about concern that there's going to be we're going to have a need, we're not going to be able to have enough to make this simcha.
Yeah, but
we're not going to.
My parents got married with nothing.
I understand. Perhaps it's just trying to express, though, a concern that this may not be a great place to live. I can see all kinds of reasons why it seems a little bit oppressive, and also why it seems somewhat more responsible, a la some of the ethics that we just mentioned now.
Because we said we shouldn't stop kala from chatula, you know.
I assume that the implication was that there are not supposed to be any marriages. That also should, new marriages should at least have, you know, does a little bit towards not having the population continue to go if there isn't enough food.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to extrapolate to the larger policy issues that it represents, that just might be the case. I think also it has to do simply with the provision that we want to create these wonderful rich simchas with sudot, with rich meals, and it'd be very hard to do that during this time.
But also I think there's a flip side. When we don't have enough, having like a big meal, we need to use whatever source is efficiently, not having the giant meal where maybe there's too much food.
Right, exactly. You know, and could be an expression of, you know, Sameach b'chalko. You could be happy with your portion.
Well, but you also don't want... I'm sorry.
Yeah, just everything I've read about food production is that, for example, you know, meat is a very inefficient way to feed people, and I wonder whether at that time, I would assume that meat was not a commonplace thing to eat. It was a special occasion kind of thing. And
not commonplace.
It also pushes toward efficient utilization of what you do have.
Right. Right, definitely. What's
your?
I was going to say that it's kind of a communal burden, that it's not like some people are celebrating. They're all kind of suffering together and tamping down the celebratory thing in order to try and influence, you know, that they would get good fortune. But, I mean, it's like in California when they have a drought and then everybody kind of works together.
Right.
To ration and to limit the amount of water that's done, and there is some sense that everybody is doing something about it.
Right.
So I think it's good for the community to kind of rally together in whichever way that culture says is productive.
Right.
In order to suffer together and rally together until, you know, when the rains came.
Right. Exactly. So that's what we'll end with. That's what I wanted to show through these reading these Mishnayot and reading the full-out drama of these Mishnayot. That my contention is, as I read, that for sure it highlights the communal acceptance of responsibility, not only for one small plot of land, but for each other's lands and each other's simchas and potential pitfalls, potential calamities. And that by reading such, and making prayer a way of answering and engaging God to help fulfill those needs, and getting to a place where the community is called together in order to do that, that they had to recognize each other's humanity in one another's presence in a prayerful, physical place. And that our prayer today still helps us provide one another spaces to bring our deepest concerns as much as our greatest simchas, and that we take more responsibility for one another as we continue to build our own prayer communities, albeit I'm not recommending everybody take on Monday, Thursday, Monday fasts.
Thank you.